is Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN. It's our daily in-depth look at people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. Now, Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Afternoon. Thanks for being here today. Boy, we haven't done this in a long time. A wine in the Umpqua. Dyson DeBar of Hillcrest Vineyards and Paul O'Brien, thanks for coming in this afternoon.
Always a great pleasure to see you, Kyle.
So, how are things looking? It's July already, which is shocking to most of us because it seems like we missed June somehow. How are things looking this summer for grapes in the Umpqua?
That is a loaded question, and I'll try to answer that the best I can. But the French have a saying, every vintage is a vintage year until it's sold out, and then you get the truth. So you always hear, oh, it's so fantastic, and then when it's all sold out, then you hear what it is. It's been an interesting year. You know, in agriculture, there's really no regular. I mean, it's nature throws different things with, you know, timing and, you know, everything from hot and dry to cold and wet at you. And this has been, once again, an interesting year. We started off actually fairly early in terms of vine push. It was kind of a drier winter. And then all of a sudden at the end, we saw, you know, in spring, a fairly wet spring. And we've just, I think, come out of that window here recently. So where the vines are now is they're pushing a lot of vegetative growth, and you see this in other plants kind of in the community, and that they're pushing a lot of vegetation, and then the fruit has set. We've pretty much finished the flowering stage of wine grapes. And something very interesting about wine grapes is most fruits and vegetables, you have male, female, and you need cross-pollination with bees, and that fine wine grapes, not all grapes, but fine wine grapes are hermaphrodites. They're actually self-pollinating. But weather is plays a big role in how things pollinate. So we saw some of the early varietals, so like with tomatoes, you have early, mid, late season varieties. The early season, mid season stuff actually had very beautiful weather that it flowered in. Some of the later season varieties, you had a little bit of rain, and so within a cluster, maybe you saw the flowers that are there. So every one of those berries, there's actually a flower associated with it that's pollinated and then turns into the berry, of course. We saw kind of an elongated window, which means on a cluster, you might see on Cabernet Sauvignon or a late ripening variety, you might have a berry that was fertilized and therefore 2 weeks ahead of maybe the later berries on that cluster. And that's part of the personality of a vintage. And that's part of the beauty of wine, is that if you make it in a way that respects the nature, it actually tells you the story of what that vintage is like. But really, the most important weather is the very end. So it's much like people that grow tomatoes, and that at the very end of the season, you know, when that fruit goes from green to red or yellow, and that's when all the flavors are all developed. That's when you have a dilution of acidity. If it's really warm outside, you know, in California, where I came from a whole long time ago, but in this area, you go walking around, and I remember as a little kid, you know, walking through creek beds, and you smell this beautiful perfume of blackberries. And so, like, in a real warm year, that's actually a problem in wine grape growing, because you're losing that perfume. The molecular weight of the perfume of grapes, and therefore fine wine, can be blown through the skin. And so, ideally, you'd like a long, cool, dry vintage that all that perfume is packed in and tucked in.
So you're basically sort of, it's almost like a slow leak. You're losing it into the air.
Yeah, oh, exactly. And so that's part of a personality of vintage. If you look at actually one of the real defining characteristics between California wines and Oregon wines, is we tend to have a lot more of that perfume. And part of that has to do with latitude, when that perfume and that flavor is being developed in like a September or October window, and that we're very cool and we're trapping that in there. If you're down in an area that your nighttime temperatures are 70 or 80 degrees, when I was at Madavi, I used to walk several hundred acres of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir down in the Carneros area, down in the cooler areas. And we'd get up first thing in the morning, you'd be out in your truck waiting for the sun to rise. As soon as the sun came up, and one of those, like, you know, 2 week heat spells or whatever, you'd get out of your car in the morning. This is like 6 o'clock in the morning, and you'd smell that fruit. Pinot Noir is a very thin skinned grape variety, so it blows through. One of the nice things about Cabernet Sauvignon, or the reason Cabernet does well so many places, it's a big old fat, thick skin. So you can't cook all the perfume out.
Wow. You know, when you're talking about the end being so important, the end of the season, and obviously over the last number of years that I've been watching this, we've gotten curveballs right at the end of the season. Sometimes it's, you get a big heat wave when you don't want one, or it's cool and so you're waiting, and then the birds start coming back, and all kinds of challenges.
Yeah. It is farming, and this is what people forget. You know, it's interesting, when you get out of your car, go into a tasting room, taste, and get back in your car and leave. The reason you have wineries in a place like this is because the nature is powerful, and even the greatest regions of the world, I mean, like like in Europe right now, I mean, they've had a lot of problems with hail where, you know, sometimes it wipes out your vintage before it even starts kind of thing. But that weather at the end is so, so critical. And that's one of the very great things about Umpqua Valley. You know, we're a little bit more protected and you find it in the northern Willamette. So you tend not to have that swing towards difficult the way you'll have it in areas that are maybe more marginal in climate. It also allows us to grow a lot of other varieties. We're slightly warmer and therefore we can grow varieties. You know, I use that analogy a lot of the tomatoes of early season. Early season fruit usually has no taste because the plant is rushing to mature its fruit, but it's really in the seed business. It's trying to procreate and want something to pick that up. So if it's the first thing out of the gate in nature, something's picking up that seed, carrying it off, fertilizing it, and dropping it kind of thing. So actually the most flavorful fruits in the world as a general rule are the ones that harvest in the middle of the season, and there's so much competition that they compete with each other, so they have to be the most flavorful or the sweetest because they have all this other competition. And then late season varieties, in the case of tomatoes, it's, you know, the canning tomatoes, they have flavor, but they're big and tough and they're meant to hang out there in difficult weather. Think about varieties like Cabernet Sauvignon, Petit Sirah. Those are kind of big and tough and those are hang out there and they trap flavors and that. But it's interesting when it comes to wine, a lot of people disconnect themselves from everything else they understand in nature and kind of their life experience and that. And in many ways, it's growing grapes and making wine is like many other things. It just has a little more magic to it.
You know, I kept mentioning tomatoes, and that I have never been good at growing much of anything. Ask Mike Winters. But a number of years ago, my wife had those. It was real popular for a while. Maybe it still is to a lesser extent. Mm-hmm. The upside down baskets of tomatoes, you would grow it that way. She had those hanging off the porch. And however long that was taking, they were doing really well. It looked really good. She was going to Washington, D.C. for a week in the summer for her job. And she reminded me to make sure and water them every night. Well, that also happened to be the week of the fair. And it happened to be the hottest week of the year. And I didn't even go outside in the back all week. And she got home from the trip and they were shot because it was that final week. They would have been just awesome. They were looking really good. But boy, I blew it at the end.
You just need to mark that as a sun-dried tomato. Your wife maybe didn't understand that.
Yeah, I don't think that went over so well. What about the COVID-19 situation? It's been interesting because, first of all, you had during the more of the shutdown phase of things, you could have your tasting room open. You couldn't do tastings. That probably had to be real hard.
It was actually forbidden until May 15th. May 15th is when we opened it up to do tastings.
So 2 months.
Yeah. So it's very interesting. I think, you know, not just in the wine industry, but if you look at business in general, there are people that have walked very, very different paths. And I, once again, this is not based on talking to everybody, but many of the wineries did incredibly well. Usually that's a slower time of the year, pre-May 15th. And so we had a lot of people, they were spending more time at home, and a lot of them were cooking more, and they were drinking more. And so they said, you came out of that, you're either going to be a really good chef or a really good drinker or both. And so we actually had kind of almost like a hoarding mentality that people were coming in and buying cases. And what was ironic is people would be in a tasting room like 2 or 3 minutes and buy two cases and leave. And so it was the human side of that. You kind of went through withdrawals that we kind of began missing, like, wow, that interaction with folks. It slowed down a little bit on the back end of that, but business was still very good. Oregon is very, very loyal to its wines, and we're so blessed to have such a great customer base in this area that supports things that I know many of the wineries did quite well. We're getting into busy season, and it was projected very early in the shutdown process domestically that people were not going to be traveling internationally, which is very difficult to do still to this day. But people were going to stay more in-country and especially more regional. And this is what we see now. We see people from, you know, Portland south, maybe Medford north, coming north, and that in our tasting rooms actually are consistently busy. And what's most interesting to me is that we're as busy sometimes in a weekday as we are in a weekend. Traditionally, until you get into the real busy part of the summer where you start seeing people from all over the country and internationally coming into a tasting room, you know, the middle of the week is a little bit slower, or the beginning of the week than the weekends and that. And so I'd have to say in the case of the wine business, and maybe not for everybody, but those that I've talked to have actually done very, very well, but there are major changes. If you look at just the economy in general, there were a lot of changes in industry, structural changes in that, and the wine industry, like other industries, the coronavirus, or COVID virus, excuse me, it's beer time, basically accelerated that. And we really still don't know where it's going to come out. I mean, I would say probably in maybe 3 or 4 months we'll have a better idea, but it's probably going to be maybe a year or two before we truly understand the changes that have been accelerated by this experience.
Going to take a break on Inside Douglas County Wine in the Umpqua, Dyson DeMar of Hillcrest Vineyards and Paul O'Brien and more. When we come back, more talk about wine, the interview, a podcast after one at 541radio.com, 1247 at News Radio 1240 KQEN. Inside Douglas County, 1248, Lars Larson at 1 o'clock. And later today, more wine on Northwest Wine Radio. Brian Calvert looking at wine, beer, and spirits around the Northwest. Dyson DeMar of Hillcrest Vineyards. You're most known for Hillcrest, but you're also a partner in Paul O'Brien, and you've got one other little venture up your sleeve.
Yeah, exactly. It's never a dull moment. So, we came up in 2001 and moved up here. I was still working for Mondavi. 2003, we purchased Hillcrest, the oldest wine grape winery in Oregon and birthplace of Oregon Pinot Noir. My wife and I were there for a number of years, and then a good friend of mine down at Mondavi was coaxed into coming up here, and he saw the same thing that we saw, just the powerful, powerful nature of this area that we're just really beginning to understand now. We started Paul O'Brien, which are two middle names, my middle name being Paul and my partner Scott Kelly, his middle name being O'Brien. And it's a very different kind of business than we have at Hillcrest. We do fine wine, but we really do. Many people are familiar, if you eat at a True or Alexander's and that, of Oregon Territory, which is a brand that we have that's a national brand. It's the biggest brand out of Umpqua Valley. We're in 35 different states. But, you know, at Hillcrest, I sell everything direct pretty much, a little bit to restaurants and that. But 99% of what we do is consumer direct, or DTC, direct to consumer, as it's called. But at Paul O'Brien, there's a lot of wine that's through distribution. So this is one of the major changes that we see with what's happened, that if you're in the right segment, which that wine is, Oregon wines, $18 to $20 are literally on fire. They're the fastest growing wines out there in the country in terms of regions. Those wines are doing incredibly, incredibly well. If you don't fit within that, there are people that are, you know, that are being challenged.
What about your third place?
Third place. So we purchased Misty Oaks about a year and a half ago, and with the idea, I'm fascinated, and actually how I ended up in Umpqua Valley is doing research on NOAA's website, punching in the climate of Piemonte in northern Italy, where the great wines of Barolo and Barbaresco and other wines are produced from the grape Nebbiolo. And so we took that over. We've named it Pazzo Colina, which means crazy hill. That's kind of a play on Hillcrest, but a very different site. I have purchased fruit off of that site in that pocket for a number of years, and it's one of the stellar vineyards in Umpqua Valley. But at some point we'll open it up with a focus on all estate bottled wines, but a lot of Italian. So we've done a lot of grafting over. I've got Sangiovese. I was just out yesterday working out in the Sangiovese, which is what Chianti and Brunello di Montalcino are made from. But that's a variety that does incredibly, incredibly well. We have experience with that. You can taste it today down at Paul O'Brien and that. But Turaldigo, which is an Italian grape that once again tied to Scott, my partner down at Paul O'Brien again, oversaw a California winery based in Napa for Mondavi that produced Italian varietals in California. And one of the varieties that we were both super excited about is a variety called Turaldigo. And I got cuttings from him, and we brought those up in 01. We produce a Turaldigo out at Hillcrest, and we'll begin to produce Turaldigo at Pazzo Colina. We do a rosé from it that's absolutely stunning wine we've just released. But that's something that's kind of on... you know, we're turning that vineyard around. That's going to be fruit sourcing. It's all hillside. It's a warmer site. It's in a bowl that's elevated up off of Coal Valley that is between where Garden Valley hits Fort McKay and Sutherland, but a super spectacular site. And it's at some point you'll see that. But, you know, wine is one of those things, a story when I worked at Mondavi, when they created a winery called Opus One that's a joint venture between a very famous winery in Bordeaux called Mouton Rothschild that's a first growth in Mondavi, is they sat down for their first planning meeting after the business was done, and the French said, oh, what do we want to know in 200 years? And we're going to set up our research project. And, you know, the Madavis were shocked because we look at everything in 3 years, 5 years. Wine, it's okay to take a little bit of time. And, you know, the most expensive thing I always say in wine is time, but that gives you an understanding of what to plant, where to plant it, how to pick it, you know, how to make it into wine and that. And so that's something for people to take, you know, we'll definitely broadcast when we open up Pazza Colina, but it'll be a very different flavor profile. And our daughter, who graduated just short while ago from winemaking school in Italy, is back in Italy right now, but she's going to help us kind of put her stamp on it for the next generation.
Now, normally when we talk during the year, you travel a lot. How's that changed for you this year?
It's changed 100%. Usually by this time of year, I've been into Europe twice, and I, of course, have not been. You cannot go into Europe right now unless you have like a very important business, let's say defense industry or something like that. Or in the case of my daughter just got on a plane in Eugene to go to, she landed in Venice yesterday to go back, but she has a student visa and she's graduated school, but she was actually working on the back end of graduation. She went and worked in the Rio Negro Valley of Argentina at a cool climate producer that does Chardonnay and Pinot, very, very famous, called Chakra. And they do like $150 Pinot Noir in Argentina that you pretty much don't see in America. And because of the virus, that winery was shut down and she was flown out of the country and she came up here. And actually, one of the nice things about what's happened is, you know, our daughter's 25, Hannah, and, you know, we thought someday, of course, she'd come back and have a spouse and this kind of thing. But we got to spend 3 months with her one-on-one and as an adult. And it was such a beautiful, beautiful experience that it's one of the things I'm most thankful for in my life.
So, but you haven't been able to go and do some of the winemaking over in Europe, though. I bet you miss that.
Yeah, I miss that. I have, in some cases, it's expensive and it's not the best way to taste. I have samples sent to me, but our daughter's going to be doing a little bit of that. She's on the ground now, like I said, in Italy, so she's going to be taking care of a little bit of stuff for us. But the challenge is those wines are made with my palate. And, you know, there's no connection between father, daughter, or husband, wife, or whatever when it comes to palate. So, you know, it's something that it just has to be delayed. Right now, I've got a container and a half of wine that's sitting in the Mosel Valley of Germany from the different places that we make in Europe. We consolidated into a place to ship, which is the Mosel, and it's sitting there. And so I'm you know, at some point going to pull the trigger on that, but it's been hard to move stuff around for sure.
So for the work that you do in Europe, is that land that you have over there, or are you making wine for other people? Or
No, it's wines that are for us. And some places we own, we do lease vineyards and that, and I even buy a little bit of fruit depending on the region and that. It's very different. When you go into areas that are very famous, land is like heirloom quality. It doesn't come up for sale. The Europeans realize something that we don't yet, and that's kind of a nice thing. And that's that when you have something that's really incredible and you sell it, you'll never get it back. So, I mean, there are people that will abandon vineyards but keep their name on the title before they actually sell a vineyard. So it's oftentimes far easier to lease vineyards. So a lot of the vineyards are leased in 99-year contracts, and, you know, we go in and buy segments or of the contract. But It's kind of a mix. I don't make wine for anybody. I mean, I taste. There's a couple people that are friends in that. So one of the things that's very unique about the wines that we produce internationally, and we have an international wine club, and we sell those at Hillcrest, is you have a palate. Like, we have a Pacific Northwest palate that we're used to certain flavors. And so people that like what I do with Oregon fruit, it's a very different interpretation than maybe what, like, we do in Spain and Poboleda, Spain, where the Catalonian palate is very different. It's super interesting because oftentimes when I go and I sit down and I'm doing my cuts and my blends, you know, dear friends of mine that I make the wines with, they'll taste it and they'll say, "Who drinks that?" Because it's so different than what they produce with fruit out of the same area. But, you know, in it's a very interesting, it's much like giving different chefs the same ingredient. My wife is a professionally trained chef, and I'll never forget being at Salishan Lodge like in 89 or 90, and they had a competition, and they gave everybody a brown bag, paper bag, with the same ingredients in it, but you didn't know what they were until you went into the kitchen, and you went into the kitchen one at a time, and they gave you 30 minutes. And so most people, it was like a piece of halibut and some vegetables, and I think it was a little bit of stock. So almost everybody did like a little, you know, maybe consomme soup, and then they did like, you know, sauteed halibut and that. And and some julienne vegetables. The gentleman that won took all those things and put them together, and he used the fish to make a reef, and he used the consomme, which is that clear, basically soup. It's a clear stock, and then he took the vegetables like the carrots and made them into little fish. So actually, what you're eating is like looking down into like a Mediterranean lagoon or something, or exotic lagoon, and the ability to go into an area that hasn't changed what they do literally in 1,000 or 2,000 years and bring in your palate and your concept, it's an amazing difference.
Wow, good insight. Dyson DeBar, Hillcrest Vineyards, Paul O'Brien, and
Pazzo Colina.
All right, thanks for coming in this afternoon. Good to see you.
Always a great pleasure. Cheers.
1258 News Radio 1240 KQEN.
Listening to Inside Douglas County on News Radio 1240 KQEN, a daily look at the people and issues that are shaping Douglas County. The show will be available as a podcast in just a few minutes at 541radio.com. So share it and let others who weren't listening live know about today's show. Inside Douglas County is a public affairs presentation of Brook Communications, your home for Douglas County's news team. News Radio 1240 KQEN.